listeners, for tuning in once again to Riding Right with the Raiders. As always, God bless America. Today, unfortunately, it will just be myself, Kevin Allen. Caleb had to run to Amarillo for some work, but we're going to get through that. Today, we have a very special guest from Lubbock, Texas, the founder of Citizens for Education Reform, Miss Susan Perez.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you go ahead and tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Well, I've been an educator most of my life, and I'm still in education. A few years ago, I was retired and just enjoying myself, went on a cruise and game night at church, and I began to learn about indoctrination that was going on in the school, especially in the curriculum and in the library books. And so I said, you know, I can't just sit around and enjoy myself when something like this is happening. I've got to jump back in and get involved. So we started an organization, Citizens for Education Reform, and we've been around for about 4 years now. And we've had a number of speakers that just helped us to figure out what's going on in education. We learned about critical race theory, social-emotional learning, comprehensive sex education, which I didn't really want to know about, but that's what everybody was concerned about. So we got a speaker from Austin to come. We also learned some good things like chaplains in schools. A bill passed in Texas to allow schools to hire a chaplain. And they don't take the place of counselors. They are there to support teachers, to help students. They can pray with students or teachers if they ask for that, but they're also trained in security and aware of what to look for in students that might be troubled and want to threaten the school. So chaplains could be a great benefit. And also, the bluebonnet curriculum in Texas has replaced a curriculum that had critical race theory, suicide, other dark themes. The bluebonnet curriculum has a leadership unit, and it includes figures like Esther, Daniel, Solomon. Why wouldn't we consider them leaders and study them along with other great leaders? So we've made some improvements in curriculum in Texas, and there are still some hurdles to overcome, but we're making progress.
Right, and I think it is important to recognize our biblical leaders. There's an argument to be made, you know, if you believe in Christ, how can you not be involved in politics? So I wanted to ask a question before we go into this, because there's a lot here at Texas Tech. We have a lot of Catholics and a lot of Christians, and I just wanted to kind of clarify, are chaplains Catholic, Christian, or can they be either?
Yes, they can be either, and I'll see if I can remember the statistics because it's been over a year since I heard these. But historically, I want to say 94% of the chaplains, military, police force, football teams all have chaplains. The Senate has a chaplain. 94% have been Christian, and I want to say 5-point-something% have been Catholic, and then there's been a really small number of chaplains from other backgrounds. So historically, most chaplains have been Christian, or a few have been Catholic, and so that's what would be expected in the future.
Does Lubbock have a chaplain, and does this carry into Texas Tech, or are colleges kind of exempt from that?
I know that there have been requests from people that work at Texas Tech to consider that, because especially in the field of health, where during COVID and just the stress of being a student going through the medical field, there has been a request to help students with mental health issues. And all these ideas are brought up. And I know there are people that keep bringing up, what about chaplains? Could we have chaplains? Now, I don't know that the legislature has passed for colleges to have chaplains, but honestly, it's been legal for schools to have chaplains since back in the 70s. There was a Supreme Court hearing back in the 70s that allowed it. So it really wasn't required for the legislature to pass that schools could have chaplains. I think it was just clarifying that they could. Now, I don't know that Lubbock has a chaplain in the school. I know there are some schools around Texas. We had a speaker that came to the Citizens for Education Reform Group, the organization that we started, and he was a chaplain in the Abilene area, but he's volunteer at this point. And so hopefully at some point these chaplains will be paid for what they're doing. I mean, they should be an employee of the school, not just volunteering. So we're hoping that that will come along.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and take us into our topics. The first one's going to be parent involvement in education. Our first question is going to be, how can we restore parental rights in the classroom, especially when it comes to curriculum transparency?
I think the parents are waking up. The parents that I have been able to visit with seem to be more aware now than they were a few years ago, and that's what it's going to take for parents to reclaim those rights. They have the rights, and our legislature has spelled out that the parents have the rights. But parents are very busy. They're trying to make ends meet, fix supper, take kids to events. They don't have a lot of extra time to get involved in the schools. But, you know, it's going to be a necessity. I mean, even if they just stop by the school twice a month for 20 minutes, you know, to visit with a teacher or to go for an hour-long PTA meeting once a month. Just a little bit of involvement will make a huge difference in the schools paying attention to what the parents think. And, you know, parents should also speak up if a school board meets at 7 a.m. and wants parents to be involved. The parents should be speaking up saying, we'd love to come, but we're getting our kids ready and off to school, so we can't be there at 7 a.m. So we need meetings at another time. But then, you know, the parents have to show up at those meetings, or else why would the school board change the time? So it is a little bit of a challenge. And I know that there are grandparents that are involved too, because, you know, grandparents have more time, and grandparents can clearly see the difference between what's in school now versus what it was when we were growing up, because I'm also a grandparent. Whereas parents were more of the generation growing up where they didn't want to offend anyone. You know, it's not my place to tell somebody whatever. Whereas the grandparents see that there is a vast difference and it is time to speak up. And so getting involved, taking a stand, being present. I've heard Charlie Kirk say at the beginning of the year, go meet the teachers, take them cookies, go about once a 6 weeks and go back and see them again. But if something is not right, go back and ask questions. Don't just let it go. So that's a huge issue on parents getting involved and making a difference.
You know, I know you know a little bit about my background, and I don't have a traditional educational background. I was very sick. My parents had to take me out of school. We didn't have a lot of money. And eventually, you know, I get a GED and pop up here in college.
Good for you.
But thank you. Even back when I was a kid, because I went till about partway through fifth grade, I do remember every semester. And every year is maybe how it worked. The parents would come in, you would meet the teacher. And back then, there was some sort of protocol where throughout the semester, the teacher would notify the parents and they would come in, go over the child's report card, go over their progress, reevaluate, you know, do they need to go to tutoring? Do they need to pursue summer school? And the teachers were really interactive with the parents, and they would wait till after class. I remember being in the school till 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night sometimes for these meetings to happen. Has education stepped back from such protocols?
I think it depends on the school district. I think what you're describing is more likely to help happen in elementary school. But also, there are schools that understand that parents are their clients and that they are there to serve the parents and the grandparents that are paying the taxes, which pay their salaries. Some schools don't seem to have that philosophy. And I will brag a little bit on Friendship ISD, because that's where I taught last. And I was at the high school, and this is probably pretty unusual for a high school, but we were expected to contact every parent before the end of the first 6 weeks. So, you know, in high school, you have seven classes with 20 to 30 kids in each class. That's a lot of parents to contact. So normally it was like a postcard, you know, I'm so glad to have whatever student in my class, and feel free to call me if you have any questions. That way, when we had a concern, the concern wasn't the first time that we met with that parent. But another thing that I think really made a difference at Friendship is we were expected to contact each parent if a student looked like they might not pass that 6 weeks before it was too late. You know, like give them an opportunity to work with their student and make a difference so that they would pass. And parents really seem to appreciate that. And I think that's because Friendship understood that parents are our clients, just like in a business, you know, you have your clients. Well, school does too. And some schools don't seem to be aware of that.
You're right. You've got to have financial support. You've got to have student turnout, student retention, and all those things cost money to keep the education system going. So having said that,
let me add one more thing before we get off of that. As an educator, I won't say always, but my last 20 years at least, I felt like my job was to educate the students, not to fail students. So if a student wanted to do better, they wanted to learn more, the parents were interested, I would help them to do whatever it took to learn more and improve their grade. It didn't matter if they had an A or a B or a C. You know, if they had an 89 and they wanted to bring their grade up to an A, why not let them do extra work and bring their grade up? Now, I would not do it the last week of the 6 weeks because, you know, they've had their chance and that's too much of a time crunch. But I don't understand where in education we've got this absolute deadline and you can't do any more to do any better. In the world of business, if you're willing to do more, you're going to achieve more. I think that applies in education also.
I love that you said that because, you know, growing up, when you're taken out of school, and my parents tried to homeschool me, it was unfortunate that it didn't work. But again, you have a lot of economics and logistics to look at for the era we tried. And it wasn't until I was 19 or 20, and I went to what's called the Dorothy Lomax Center in Lubbock, or was called. Huh. I don't know if it still is. And there was a gentleman named Leo Flores. And he sat me down and he heard my story. And he said, I want you to know, Kevin, that you didn't fail. Your teachers failed you. Because there was times where I tried and tried, like with algebra. And I had a teacher at a certain elementary here that her tactic, and my parents were going through a divorce at the time. And so I was already having a hard time and doing what I could. And I just wasn't understanding. And to try and get me to learn the material, she would humiliate me in front of the class, scream and yell at me.
Wow.
And she tried to say she wasn't, but we had a really good principal that kind of stood not far from the door one morning and caught her doing it. And then you had like 10 or 12 classmates say, no, that really is happening to him. And that was dealt with immediately once it got out.
That's good.
It wasn't long after that that I was taken out of school because I started having surgeries and I couldn't keep up. Not long ago, we had the LISD bond, and it is what it is. It passed. But and this is why I got involved. There was a huge transparency issue going on, and I wanted to take the time to ask this. Would you, or is there legislation? If there's not, would you support it? That would require schools to notify parents about all materials being taught, especially those involving gender, sex, ethnicity, race, etc.
I think there is already legislation that requires that transparency. I think it's already passed. I think it passed 2 years ago.
Okay. I'm just asking because I know in Lubbock we've had issues with, I don't know what school it was, but it was brought to my attention at like a meeting. Kids were having to sign, like, you know, what gender do you identify as and stuff like that. And I was just kind of like, that's an odd question to be asking. And this is elementary, by the way, this is in high school. And I was like, that's a very odd question to be asking kids, because that was the last thing on my mind as a kid. Does Lubbock not follow that? Or how are the school boards in Lubbock or the schools in general with following that type of legislation?
My understanding from the administration is that question did not come from the administration. So that must have been just a lone teacher. And I mean, that does happen in any district where a teacher goes out on their own and does something they're not supposed to do. And as long as we can find out who the teacher is and talk to the next level up, it usually gets dealt with. And of course, I think we've also turned the curve of, you know, that parents are not going to allow that. I mean, parents all across the United States have spoken that that's not the school's place to be addressing that. And so I think the teachers have backed down from trying to work behind the parents' back and that kind of thing, especially in Texas, because there has been legislation for this transparency. So I think that we've turned the corner on that, and we're, you know, on the right direction of getting that taken care of.
That's great to hear. That's a step in the right direction, in my opinion.
Another thing that I think would help and make a difference is our churches getting engaged. I'm not sure that pastors and churches understand how important it is to get involved in social issues, because our founding fathers had pastors that talked about social issues like freedom from England, taxation without representation, and what the Bible says about that and what could be done about that. That's how our founding fathers knew to take a stand, because it was discussed at church. Now, some pastors say, my job's not to reform the school. My job is to pastor my flock or shepherd my flock. But I don't know how you shepherd a flock if you're not aware or addressing what's going on in their lives. Like if the kids are being exposed to sexually explicit materials and that's not discussed at church. I mean, it might be discussed in the youth department and the adults aren't aware of it, but somehow those kids and those parents need to know how to deal with that. That's a very important issue, because there is research that shows that if a child is exposed to pornography or wording that is sexually explicit when they're young, it reroutes the neural pathways, makes it so that child cannot take a stand. And it's very important for our children and our adults to know, first of all, what to watch out for and how to stop that, how to take a stand. So in my mind, it's very important for our churches to get involved in education and other issues in society.
I agree wholeheartedly. Even growing up, I had a lot of pastors that I would lean on for support with everything that I went through, and they were an integral part of my upbringing and why I chose to keep pursuing education. But I'm going to backtrack here, and then we're going to talk more about pastors and societal issues. What role do you think school boards should play in ensuring parents have a say in school policy, and how can we better equip parents to be more effectively engaged in local school board elections?
See if I can address all of that. Okay, so one of the issues is that Texas Association of School Boards writes the policies for probably 1,100 of the 1,200 schools in Texas. And their training teaches the school board that their job, at least this is what I'm told, their job is to support the administration of the school. And I know they used to teach that once you're elected to the school board, you're no longer responsible to the constituents. You're responsible to the district. Well, that is absolutely not true. The people in the community that elect those school board members, that's who the school board is responsible to. So the school board is to be a watchman for the community. And when I was a superintendent, that is what school boards did. I mean, they weren't like my best friend and on my side all the time. I was having to work to help the school board understand why I was proposing something, because the school board was looking at it from the parent's point of view. And that is what the school board should do. They should always be on the lookout for, is this the best in the best interest of the students? Is this in the best interest of the parents? They should not be rubber stamping what a superintendent wants or the administration wants. They should be looking at it from the point of view of the parents. And I hope that that's what most school board members intend to do. Now, I will say it is very hard. It's a thankless job. I'm sure there's lots of complaining. There's a lot of information to know about and to understand when you're on the school board. So it is a little overwhelming to figure it out and to be a watchman on the wall. It is much simpler to just go along with the administration. But the longer a person's on the school board, the more they should be able to to do that, to learn more about it and to speak up. And of course, Texans for Excellence in Education is another policy organization, and they also provide training. And I'm going to say TEE instead of Texans for Excellence in Education, but their training is online. And so those schools that have joined that or association or organization for policy and for training and for insurance are able to get their training throughout the year. They don't have to go off to Houston for a week. It's not really expensive for the school. And their policies and their training is in line with the law. I mean, like almost word for word from the law and the Constitution, so that the school district is protected if they're ever in a lawsuit because they're following the law. And so I would think that that would be ideal to have policies like that that are aligned with our legislation. And as we've mentioned, our legislation has already passed that parents are in control of their children's. They're the first one to make decisions about the child and to be concerned about the children.
Right. So just to be clear, keeping the parents and what they want first would help a lot.
Yes. The hard part is you have some parents and some parents that want a different thing. So that's when it gets complicated. That's why it's good to have solid policy to guide the school board in those situations.
It keeps it from running off the rails. That's a great point and connection to make. And when you talk about parents, especially here in Lubbock, we have a lot of churches. I mean, we really do.
We have a lot
of churches in Lubbock. You get pastors of all ages, and we've definitely seen an uptick in younger pastors since I was a kid. I want to ask, how can churches be more active in standing against cultural ideologies entering schools and their communities? And what would you say to pastors who are hesitant to speak on political and cultural issues for fear of losing a nonprofit status or their members?
I know that is a challenge. And a friend and I are going to a conference in Fredericksburg next week, and it's called Liberty Pastors. And it is aimed at helping pastors to understand the legal standing of what they can say, because they actually have a lot more leeway than many pastors believe. There are a lot of things they can talk about from the pulpit that are okay to talk about, but we have been, I don't want to say hoodwinked, but some, you know, where we think we can't say things, and so we self-censor. And so we're trying to get this same group, I don't know that it's Liberty Pastors Group, but some of those same organizations that we'll be presenting, to come to Lubbock next year for the 250th anniversary of the United States. And the Black Robe Regiment has been to Lubbock before. They're going to be in Fredericksburg, and we hope they'll come to Lubbock next year in 2026. Patriot Academy has biblical citizenship, which we've taught several times in Lubbock. It helps everybody, not just pastors, understand what are our biblical basis as far as the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. What did our founding fathers think about? What's the basis for our nation? Because it was founded on biblical principles. So all of that helps pastors to understand what they can say and what they're able to convey to the congregation, which makes a difference, because back in the 60s, pastors began to hear from somebody, not from the Bible, and limiting them on what they felt like they could say from the pulpit. And so that has carried on. And so this is kind of undoing that and teaching pastors and helping them to understand how they can take a stand. And it's in the best interest of the congregation and our society. If pastors teach what is the biblical basis of this and the congregation is aware of it.
It sounds like you're of the same belief I am, and that's that it's very crucial. Christian leaders address issues like parental rights when it comes to education from the pulpit, because they are directly involved. And I think just being a pastor, I think there is an argument there that says, hey, you're a pastor, you're in a position, you're going to have to take on politics at times, and that comes with the territory. There's a lot of spiritual warfare when you talk about politics. And I said that to say, believe that faith-based voices are underrepresented in policy decisions affecting families and education?
Yes, I think more and more people are beginning to get involved, and it's biblical that we are supposed to get involved. the government is established in the first few books of the Bible. And as Charlie Kirk says, most of this that you're talking about is not political. It is biblical, because every topic is addressed in the Bible. The only time it becomes political is when people say one thing to one group and a different thing to another group, and they try to badmouth other people to get reelected, that kind of thing. That's politics. But as far as taking a stand, whether you're on the left or on the right, it needs to be a stand based on biblical principles. And so if we want Christians and people with biblical principles making decisions, we have to get involved, or else the other people are going to be making the decisions. And leadership is also spelled out in the Bible. I mean, we are to be the leaders. We are to be involved. We're to multiply and populate the earth. So if we don't take that stand, somebody else will. And that's what's happened to our nation right now. Many Christians have not been getting involved, and they've been saying, well, I pray, but I don't vote. But we are supposed to vote. If you study all of the Bible, it's pretty clear that we are to be a part of. The government was delegated to the Christians in the first books of the Bible. The legislature, the judicial branch, the executive branch, those are set up in the Bible.
Which, and I don't know if schools are still set up this way. I know for the most part they are, but I know a lot of them have combined different age levels. So you have pre-K, elementary, then you did have junior high, and then you have high school. So out of those categories, which one of those would you say that we've probably failed the most, or that we need to maybe intervene a little bit more on? Because K through 12 is broad, and I'm wondering if there's a certain demographic to target there.
Well, the last few years I've been learning about classical education, which is Christian-based. A lot of times it's a classical Christian school, but I'm going to call it classical education. I learned about it through Pete Hegseth's book, Battle for the American Mind. And there are three parts to it, and they all three need some improvement. So the lower grades are called grammar. So we used to call it grammar school. Well, now we know why. The basis of classical education is not preparing for the next test or the next grade or for college, any of that. It is helping the child to identify their own strengths and their own talents and what their purpose is on this earth. That is a whole different way to look at education. And in grammar school, in classical education, there's a lot of memorizing, because kids are great at memorizing. So we should be exposing them to high quality literature, poetry, memorizing basic facts, and giving them visual cues so that they remember what they've memorized. Like, they could memorize 12 states and the capitals and learn something about each state, learn the first 12 presidents. I mean, I'm just breaking it down so you're not trying to learn all of it at once. You know, the first president, something about each president, some of their leadership traits. And then the next year they could learn some more. But memorizing is a great thing in the lower grades, and exposing them to quality literature. Then in junior high, I believe it's called rhetoric. And at junior high, those kids love to argue. So classical schools teach them to debate and to do it well, and they begin reading the Great Books series, which is about 70 books. It almost looks like a set of encyclopedias. It's all the Socrates, Aristotle, Karl Marx, I mean, all the great writers. And I know some people say, well, why would you study Karl Marx? Well, how do you know what socialism is and why you wouldn't want to be a part of it if you don't know anything about it? So you should read those kind of books. In junior high, students read those books and take notes, as our founding fathers did. Those books have not been used in public schools in about 100 years, so we're not familiar with them, but they are coming back. And when the children read those, that is very high quality literature. And if they take notes on it, then they can use it to support their debate, as our founding fathers did. You know, we have people that are speaking from their opinion and acting like it's fact, and they don't want to listen to the other side because they don't have any basis for what they're saying. But in classical schools, they are teaching them how to take notes and have basis and support their ideas with facts and documents from literature. And then in high school, they carry that on out and read more of those books and take more notes, and they even write a thesis. So juniors and seniors in these classical schools write a 30-page thesis, not on the topic that the teacher assigns, but on a topic that interests the students based upon their talents and their skills. So they're already being prepared for what they're going to do after school because they're exploring their own interest. And I'm told that students from the classical education score about 300 points higher on the SAT, according to the statistics. So apparently they're doing something correctly. They also spend a lot more time outside. The kids have more recess. They eat lunch outside because being out in God's world and in the sunshine helps us to think more clearly. It makes us more creative. You know, all of that's a healthy thing to do.
That was a big part of my growing up. And I've definitely noticed that we've really leaned, I want to say excessively, into technology. I think it has a place, but I think we've leaned way too much into it in certain ways, and that we need to get back to getting outside and really educating future generations. And that takes us into reclaiming biblical education, which from my understanding is an 8-week course. How does that compare to a normal semester with current students?
Biblical education is actually a course I developed. And so I had been doing coaching with parents and grandparents through Zoom to help them understand what's going on in education as far as the indoctrination, critical race theory, social emotional learning, comprehensive sex education, but the good things also, the chaplains in schools, the bluebonnet curriculum, classical education. I also was helping them to overcome fear and confusion and learn to take a stand for their family's Christian values in education. So they learn things that they could say to speak up, things that they could do to take a stand, and it's all biblically based. And after I did that for a few years, I thought, why don't I turn this into an online course so that it's easier for people to access it? So it's really not a class in school. It is a way for parents to learn and grandparents to learn how to take a stand in education. And our last session is the participants participate what they have done to get involved in education. So basically, as a teacher, I require a project. And there are two ways they can approach this project, because there's no point in learning all this if they don't do something with it. So they can either find a way to help incorporate biblical values into education. And I'll give you some examples. One participant created a box in the teacher's workroom with permission from the school, and the people in the workroom could put in a prayer request, and she'd go by once a week and pick those up and pray for whatever they asked for. Another approach is to fight against indoctrination, attend school board meetings, become a part of PTA, volunteer in the school, substitute teach. So basically just find out what's going on in the school, and once they are aware of these things that could be a problem, then they can begin to speak up if needed, or they can incorporate other parents that might want to get involved. Because, you know, if one person goes to a school board meeting, that's one thing. But if 20 people show up at a school board meeting, that makes a difference. So, you know, just kind of helping people understand what they could do to get involved in education to make a difference. So it is an online course that I've created, and it can be accessed at www.educationempowermentcoach.com. And if you click on the store, you'll see the Reclaim Biblical Education course there. So it's just something that I have developed because I feel like, as we've talked, you know, parents are a little confused about what they could do to get involved. They might be a little inhibited. They don't want their child to be singled out. And so it's a way to form a group, and many people get together and figure out how to make things better in education. And the curriculum and the books, because teachers are really, for the most part, very good teachers. They're good people. They want to do the best. Their hands are tied in some ways, but we're here fighting to help the teachers. We're not fighting against the teachers. The curriculum has been the problem, and the library books have been the problem.
Just to be clear here, can younger parents benefit from this course?
Absolutely. Anybody that has children in education, is concerned about education, has grandchildren, it's a benefit for them to learn this.
Interesting. I'm actually friends with a Republican politician, and she is one of the most patriotic educators I've ever met. And we'll talk about her another time, but I am definitely going to put this in front of her and let her look at it because I don't know if she's ever come across it.
Well, and just so you know, I'm about to offer another live course. I mean, I've created this online course that people can just watch, but I'm working on setting up another live course so that I would be actually interacting with the people that take the course, which is a little bit different approach. You know, we would meet one night a week, you know, say Tuesday night from 6 to 7. And so, you know, 12 people that are interested, for example, would all be on the Zoom meeting at the same time. And there would be a 20 or 30 minute presentation. And then there would be 20 or 30 minutes for each person to discuss. Sometimes I stop in the middle and get input also on how it impacted them or something that they learned, because I want them to speak about it also. It helps them to formulate their thoughts, and they're going to remember it longer if they talk about it. But also it's good to hear each other's point of view about things also, or experiences that they've had. So it's just more interactive instead of you just sitting down watching the course from home.
Hearing about that, it really sounds like you're a faith-based educational entrepreneur, and that's something that I really commend, because I can't even fathom what it takes to set up those type of courses. And I'm wondering, is there a place for churches and certain ministries to implement this 8-week course if their congregation is interested?
Yes, and that's actually how I started out when I created the online version. I started going to churches to see if they would want to offer this. So it'd be sort of like going to a Tuesday night Bible study, but instead of actual Bible study, they would be learning biblically how to engage in society by getting involved in education. Another way that this could work is Charlie Kirk has taken on Patriot Academy's biblical citizenship. And what I mean is Rick Green in Patriot Academy has created biblical citizenship, which teaches the biblical basis for the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, the Founding Fathers. But Charlie Kirk has helped churches to pay for it, to provide the books for it, to provide pizza for the people that attend it. I see biblical citizenship as a follow-up. So once they've learned about the biblical basis of our nation and the Constitution, if they want to get involved, this is a way to get started. So education affects everybody, because the next generation that comes up, if they've been indoctrinated, sexually explicit books have affected them, changed the neural pathways of their brain, it's going to affect all of us. When we are waited on by, you know, somebody at a food place, if they have a good education, it's one thing. But if they've not been taught basics, that's another thing. So getting involved in education, if a person's interested in that at all, this is a course that helps them know how to do that. And it will help the children in our nation. It will help clean up the indoctrination. It'll help clean out the sexually explicit books. It'll make a difference to the next generation if people will get involved in this.
We keep talking about indoctrination, and it's something that I've also drew lines on. Just for our younger audiences or people that are just tuning in or new to politics and faith-based curriculums, what is the difference between classical education versus indoctrinational education?
Well, let's see if I can explain that. One characteristic of indoctrination is where you turn your head and don't want to confront anybody and say, well, I don't want to offend anyone. Well, who taught you that? That is not biblical. In fact, I don't know any characters in the Bible that acted like that. Jesus spoke up. He overturned the tables from the money changers. Paul spoke up. Esther took a stand. I mean, the examples in the Bible took a stand. They didn't talk about if they were going to offend someone. So that is indoctrination. Cancel culture, where we think that we can't speak up, and so we self-censor and don't say things because we don't want to confront somebody. We don't want to hurt somebody's feelings. Again, that is indoctrination. Critical race theory, where people are grouped and judged by the color of their skin, not their characteristics. We thought we had overcome that in the United States, but it came back. That's indoctrination. The words white supremacist, oppressor, oppressed, that's indoctrination. Comprehensive sex education, where especially in states like California, where they've gone way beyond just teaching the birds and the bees and, you know, how to protect yourself and that kind of thing. I mean, that is indoctrination. So it's something that has been brought in for about 50 years. And originally it came from Planned Parenthood, and I can't remember the name of the organization from the United Nations. And people, there is a documentary. See if I can think of the name of it. Anyway, in the documentary, at the end, they say, people say that our education system has failed, but it has actually accomplished exactly what those people, Planned Parenthood and this organization with the United Nations, intended 50 years ago. The intent was to sexualize our children, to lower the moral standards, to cause kids to think it's okay to have sex, to get pregnant, to go have an abortion. It's an industry that makes money for groups like Planned Parenthood. All of that is what I consider indoctrination. And the sexually explicit books in the library add to it.
Yeah, that definitely was not a thing when I was growing up.
I retired in 2017 and I wasn't aware of any of this. I mean, that's how recently that, maybe it was in other states, but I wasn't aware of it as a teacher.
Yeah, we didn't really have that in schools. We had stuff that, you know, it would have some cuss words in it and it would start touching on inappropriate stuff, but it wouldn't. And I think that may have been the door, because it didn't go into it. But it said enough that if you're junior high school, you know what they're talking about. Right. And I was reading that in the fourth grade. So
from the school, was it in the school?
Yes, ma'am. I went to Bayless Elementary and here in Lubbock, Texas. So you're also the founder of Citizens for Education Reform here in Lubbock, correct?
Yes.
What prompted you to start the organization and what is your core mission?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I was retired and enjoying myself and started seeing this indoctrination creep into our schools. I was at a meeting in Lubbock where they played a video talking about how the curriculum had been indoctrinated, because the curriculum was coming from Chicago and Eastern states. There wasn't a curriculum that could be purchased by the schools that didn't have, you know, critical race theory, social emotional learning, comprehensive sex, all those things we've already talked about. That's when I began waking up. And so there were a couple other educators that had doctorate degrees, a lot of credentials, and they were also interested. And so we decided to start this organization in Lubbock. And mainly at first, so we could learn. And so we only meet quarterly because we don't intend to just sit at a table and meet. We intend to make a difference and get involved. So some of the things that we've done, we've had a school board forum to hear from all seven school board members. Well, actually only six got to come. But that way we could help the public to see which ones were more conservative, which ones were more liberal and supported those things that we've called indoctrination. And that really helped the last school board election. We've also gotten involved in legislation. 2 years ago, there were about 10 really good education bills that passed to stop the diversity, equity, inclusion funding at the university level, to support parent rights, to stop the sexually explicit books in the libraries, but it has helped some schools and some schools have resisted it. Anyway, there were about 10 really good bills getting chaplains in schools approved, but, you know, we helped lobby for those. And then this organization has gone on to our next meeting is July 25th. We meet on on a Friday, the first quarter of the month on a Friday to learn about, and this time we're learning about the changes in the health of children, you know, the food that's not very pure, it's got chemicals in it, the red dyes, the things that are in the air, and then the ladies that are presenting are talking about what they have, that's parents with young children, what they have found to do about it, you know, how to improve. I know John F. Kennedy is making a big difference in that also, so I'm really cheering him on. But as parents, we need to be aware of the plastics and the additives and the flour that has the nutrition taken out of it if you don't grind your own wheat. A lot of parents are grinding their own wheat, making their own bread. So that's our next meeting. The meeting after that, we're probably going to hear from somebody that's got an 18-point plan to improve education in Texas. So we just take one topic at a time. We have really, really worked for about 2 years to get the sexually explicit books out of the schools in the Lubbock area. And as I said, some schools just take them out and some of them are not. So it's a learning process and we are not giving up, but we're starting to appeal some books that a committee has made a decision that those books will stay in. And we're appealing that decision and we're willing to go all the way to the Texas Education Agency and beyond if we have to, because these books are not appropriate.
I know you've talked a little bit about Charlie Kirk, but have y'all interacted with Ashley Cash at all?
Yes, she's the one. Well, we haven't actually got to visit with her, but she's the one that has the 18-point plan to improve education in Texas. So we hope to meet with her soon and see if we can't work together, see what we can do to, you know, because we don't want to just fight the bad things in education. We want to replace it with good things. So we want to have a way to fill in the gap. Once we take out something, what's going to fill that gap? So we're ready to come alongside her and help her with this.
I think I know the answer to the question I want to ask, but I want to branch a little bit. What do you think the most pressing educational issues are facing the Lubbock Independent School District and surrounding areas?
Let's see. I think there's a huge gap between the pay scale of the administration and the pay scale of the teachers and then the other staff, like bus drivers, custodians. I think we should freeze salaries over $100,000 and let everybody else catch up. Focus on the people that are just barely getting by. If we could restore discipline in the classrooms, and I think the legislation is helping with that, I think qualified teachers would stay in the classroom. If we could deal with the indoctrination, we are cleaning up the curriculum, you know, only one subject at a time. Right now, there's bluebonnet math, there's bluebonnet reading, and we're hoping to have classical education added to social studies. But quality teachers want better pay. They want to be able to have a calm, quiet classroom, you know, where the kids are orderly, which I'm calling discipline, but orderly, and a good quality curriculum. I'm sure there are more things, but those are the basics that I can think of that all the schools, some more than others, can work on. I felt like when I was in Friendship, we had good class discipline. I felt like I had good curriculum, but I taught health science. I was in the medical field. I feel like the other teachers felt the same way. They were having to rewrite the curriculum so that they weren't being indoctrinated by Common Core and C-Scope that was coming from the federal government. They were trying to make it so it was the best education possible with meeting the federal guidelines, but going way beyond that. And we had an excellent school at Friendship, I felt like. And obviously, I mean, it's grown and grown and grown and grown. So apparently the people support that and believe that. And it's not the only good school. It's just the one where I taught that I'm familiar with. But I would say those are the main things that would make a difference in education. And then, you know, parental involvement where parents understand, not where they go up there and try to boss people around and tell them what to do, but just care about their own children and a conservative approach to education.
How can your younger conservatives, like students here at Tech, LCU, SPC, younger conservatives as a whole, and when I say younger, I'm talking ages 18 to 40, how can they get involved with your organization and better support Citizens for Education Reform?
Well, they can come to our next meeting because it is aimed at parents. And I know, you know, people are becoming more and more aware of the health and the food and the chemicals in the air and all those things, but we can always learn more. So July 25th at 11:30, Lubbock Women's Club. We do ask you to RSVP ahead of time if you plan to eat, though, because we can't order you a meal if you haven't signed up ahead of time. So let me give that information, and then I'll talk a little bit more. So if you're interested in that, the email address is CITZ4ED@gmail.com. So that's sort of like Citizens for Education Reform, but CITZ4ED@gmail.com to get information on how to RSVP and pay for your meal ahead of time, which is what we prefer to get involved in Citizens for Education Reform. But as young people, we've actually talked about two groups. So the college age, I've been really impressed in how active your group is and how you've gotten involved and campaigned. And that's really important to learn the ropes ahead of time. You know, our representative, Carl Tepper, started getting involved at a very young age. And then he was our county chairman. And then he was in Austin working with the legislature. So that's how he got elected, because he learned at a young age. So, you know, going and working for a campaign, working for a legislator, working for the county chair, getting involved that way. And then the young parents that you're talking about up to 40, you know, those are the ones that I didn't know this as a parent, even though I was involved in education. I didn't look at what my child was learning every day. I didn't look at what books that they were reading. I didn't look at what the teachers were teaching them. But if I was a parent now, I certainly would be, because during COVID, we became aware of a lot of things that we were not aware of. I think a lot of people woke up. But, you know, some parents are still going by, well, here's the way my daughter said it. She said, "Mom, in school, we were taught, just keep your head down, mind your own business, don't buck the system." And a lot of parents operate that way. But we've got to be aware. We can't be letting other people have their way with our children if we're not even aware of what's going on. We've got, I mean, the school is in loco parentis. They're in place of the parent. So the parents need to be aware of not just the school, but any, you know, whether it's at gymnastics or ballet or wherever they're taking their child. Stay around and watch and see how they're being taught. And, you know, like you were basically bullied for a while. You know, parents should be watching and seeing what's going on. It's kind of unfortunate that our kids can't just be left on their own and learn responsibility by playing outside without being supervised. But that's not the time that we're living in anymore. We have to be watching and be aware.
First of all, thank you for complimenting the Tech College Republicans. We have worked very hard to integrate into the Lubbock County Republicans, Lubbock Area Republicans, Conservatives Action Network, and other institutions and orgs across Lubbock, as has the Federation at the state level, which I'm now part of.
Awesome.
I've always made the argument, you know, and I may not always agree with my university. I'm not always going to agree with my city leaders or state leaders. No one's going to be aligned 100%.
Exactly.
But I do think, in my opinion, that complacency is what kills conservatism. And I urge people not to become complacent, because if you do, that's how this stuff slips through the cracks. And then once it takes root, it's literally like weeds. It's really hard to get rid of it and get your lawn back the way it was supposed to be.
Exactly.
And that takes us into a really hot topic, especially here in Texas. Now, I want to preface this. I have not physically been to any school and seen this. I have been given books. I've been shown the materials, and I'm aware that it's there, due to connections I have at the Capitol, in D.C., and other areas. But let's talk about sexually explicit books in school libraries. And I want to start off kind of strong here, because we deal with this as Tech Republicans at Tech a lot, because Democrats and others like to spin it. What is your response to critics who say removing sexually explicit books is censorship?
Well, what I say is those children... can get those books. They can get them online. They can get them at another library. They can get them through Amazon. They don't have to get them at their school. We are not denying their First Amendment right to call the library and make it appropriate for the age group that goes to that school.
You're absolutely right. I think you do hit an age where you've got enough freedom as a teenager. Let's face it. Most of us, and when I say us, I'm talking about the younger audiences, the college students. We've all been to Barnes and Nobles. We know what's there. We've all looked at the books. But to me, that it should not be part of education. I'm all for understanding I'm a male, you're a female, the difference. But beyond that, I don't think schools should be teaching. What's a good way to put this? I think it's important to know how our bodies work, right? Because we do live in a generation where you do see pregnancy at a younger age. However, I don't think it needs to go past that. I think they've gone way too far. They're teaching BDSM and stuff that has no place near kids, near education. It does not need to be indoctrinating kids to think this is part of life and this is what we're part of. You have personally reviewed any of the books that are currently in question, and what did you find most concerning?
You know, it's not possible to go into a school nowadays unless you have permission, because they are locked up to be safe. And you have to go through the screening process with your driver's license into the office and have permission and somebody you're going to see. But we can see the online card catalog, and we can see the reviews of the books. And the books that we are trying to remove from the school libraries are books that are written for sexual arousal. That is not appropriate at the school age level. That being on a school library shelf implies that the school condones those books. And as I just mentioned, they can get those books on their own somewhere else, but they don't need to be on the library shelf. And innocent children that don't know about that don't need to be reading about it at school. If parents want their kid to have that book, they can get it for them themselves. That doesn't mean the library has to offer it for them. And there was a recent decision, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, for Bonnie Wallace's lawsuit in Llano, Texas, where the public library had sexually explicit books in the children's section, and that library moved them to the adult section. One person in town was offended by that and sued, and they've been in a lawsuit for at least 3 years. I don't know how long. And there was finally a decision, and that judge had some common sense, and he said, librarians have been culling the libraries for a century to make the material appropriate for the people that use the library. And yes, librarians can remove those materials. And so, thank goodness, now librarians realize, oh, we can take these books out. We don't have to have them in here. The parents can get them somewhere else, but they don't need to get them from the library.
And just to make this black and white for our listeners, when we're talking about sexually explicit books and pornographic materials and being in children's sections, are we talking about explicit images, drawings, etc., or is it just text on pages, or is it both?
Both.
Wow, that's... It seems like there is a law being broken there somehow, or there should be, in my
opinion.
Well,
there's a board policy being broken there. We've been reading the board policy that the schools around us have, and it says that the school board will not allow sexually pervasive, unsuitable education materials to be in the libraries. So they have it in their policy that they won't allow it, and yet they're not removing them. Now, honestly, I don't know that it was intentional for these books to be in the libraries. I sat by somebody at a meeting that was at a small school, and I said, so do you have these books in your library? And they said, ironically, my wife is the part-time librarian, and yes, we have them too, and she just takes them out. So these books were sent as part of a set, as a free book, as an award-winning book. They were sent to the schools, probably without the schools being aware of it, because librarians are required to have all these different genre. And, you know, the librarians don't read thousands of books to see what every book is that's in their library. So I don't know that librarians were aware that these books were in there. Every school has these books, large or small, unless they have a really conscientious librarian that's taken them out. But I will also say I'm aware that after Bonnie Wallace went to El Paso, They took the books out. Julie Pickren, the state board member from the Houston area, said four large schools in her area have taken the books out. Midland ISD has taken those books out. Canyon ISD has taken those books out. None of those schools have gotten sued. So there's really not a fear to say, oh, well, we can't take them out because we'll get sued. I don't know where that's coming from, but I don't believe that that's true. It's a choice of the school if they want to pursue it and get those books out and get it cleaned up, or if they don't want to.
So, and you don't have to name drop here for legal reasons unless you want to or you're comfortable, but are there, I'm going to use the term umbrella companies that are behind getting and sending and pushing these books into schools?
Yes, the American Library Association, the Texas Library Association, the teachers' unions like the American Federation of Teachers, the National Education Association, Scholastic Books, Scholastic Book Fairs. I sat by a lady at a meeting one time that was from Idaloo, and she was working at the Scholastic Book Fair, and the administration told her to go through the books and pull any that you don't think are appropriate for children. And this was 3 or 4 years ago. She said she had a stack up to her hip that, you know, the stack was that high of books that were not appropriate because Scholastic Books had become indoctrinated. Now, Kirk Cameron has a book fair that he is using to try to replace Scholastic Books. He has Brave Books. He has Tuttle Twins. My 6-year-old granddaughters love to watch Tuttle Twins. I believe it's on Yippee and on Angel apps on your phone or on your computer. And it's about the founding of our nation and political issues. And I would have never thought 6-year-olds would enjoy watching that. And they are just fascinated by it. And the questions they ask after it are amazing because it's educational. Not only is it clean, but it's educational. So I have one idea of what we can do about this. You didn't ask what the solution is, but I just came up with one today, or God put it in my mind. Bonnie Wallace has a list of 890 books that should not be in school libraries. Any parent that wants to have that list just needs to email me, and I'll send you that list. Because the schools say, if parents don't want their kids to have certain books, just tell them to give me a list, and we'll make sure they don't see those books. So if the schools aren't taking the books out, parents can give them that list of 890 books and say, I don't want my child to see any of those. And we'll just put the work back on the school for getting this done.
So you're saying that if they go to your website, they get your list, or you email them and they get the list, the parents themselves can intersect and say, hey, my child goes to this school, but they're not allowed to read or take home any of these books. Here's the list. Does the school then have to comply, or what happens?
It's called opt out. And that's one of the things I teach in my course, that you can opt out of things you don't want your child to be a part of. For example, I had a parent that called upset about the Amplify curriculum when it was being used. And I said, you can opt out of that. They cannot make your child feel uncomfortable. They cannot single your child out so that they feel like they're being singled out. And the school must provide comparable education, but with different materials. So you can do the same thing with the library books. And the schools here, Lubbock in particular, has said, tell the parents to send a list of books they don't want their child to read. And that just occurred to me today. Okay, we have that list. Let's start sending them that list of 890 books and let them opt every child that the parents don't want them to see those books. If they don't remove those books, then the parents can opt them out.
Wow, that's real interesting, and I'm glad. I believe I have actually looked at your list before, and there was some pretty disturbing stuff that I pulled up. I just couldn't comprehend how it even passed in as a children's book. It was explicit's the not the right word. This was warped.
It's pornographic. It's what it is. And the sad thing is, in the literary world, 12 is considered an adult.
Is that a Texas thing or a U.S. thing?
I'm not sure. I know it's, as far as library materials, 12 is considered an adult. So it might be in the United States. So that's why 12-year-olds are able to get some of this material. But the schools have the option. There is a court case called PICO versus the Board of Education. It's the only Supreme Court ruling on removing books in education, and it's not definitive, but it is the only thing that we've got. And basically, it says school boards have the authority to remove these books that are not appropriate for children.
Oh, that's really interesting. I've got one last question here. If you had any advice for young Republicans, young conservatives, just students and young parents, young adults that they want to get involved, they want to help you, and keep in mind a lot of these students, they have access to all across Texas, all across the US. What kind of advice would you give for them going forward as getting involved and staying grounded in your principles when addressing these issues?
One of the things I've learned at the end of my life, I'm 72, and I probably in the last 15 years, I've become more and more aware that when I am taking a stand, I used to think it was important to compromise and back down and be humble and submissive, but I have learned that when I've prayed and I've been given what I'm to do, and right now what I'm to do is to work on getting these sexually explicit books out of the libraries. When there is resistance, it's not time to back down. It is time to press in, lean into that, because that is what God has given me to do. And the enemy is trying to intimidate me. And I no longer back down. And you know what? I'm still standing. And so is Bonnie Wallace, because that's what we've been given to do, is to work on that. And it's something that's important for the children. So that's also why I know it's right. And it's not the time to back up. It's time to press in harder. And that's what it means to take a stand. And you know, our world is at a crossroads right now. It's kind of like being on the Titanic and saying, I don't want to rock the boat. Well, the boat is sinking. So start taking a stand, or that boat is going to sink and we're all going to be on it. We've all got to join together. There are millions of us that feel this way. So we've all got to work together to make a difference and take a stand.
That is absolutely powerful. It's something young adults need to hear. I'm going to ask a favor just to take us off here. Instead of ending with the usual thanks for listening and tuning in to Riding Right with the Raiders, I'm going to ask Miss Perez if you would take us out with a prayer.
Absolutely. Thank you. Dearly Father, thank you for being a part of making a difference, especially in education, for such a time as this. Thank you for the people that are coming alongside me and working together to make a difference for the children, to clean up education, to clean up the library books, to help train up our children so that they're strong children that can take a stand and that they can guard against deception and stand for truth. Thank you for the training that you have given me and the whole life that in education has prepared me to be in this situation. And I am not on a hill. I'm just a watchman on the wall saying, look what's going on over there. Thank you for giving me that opportunity. But for all the people that are coming alongside, because it takes all of us to do this. So thank you for all the people that you're bringing along so that we can all take a stand for our Christian values and to make a difference, because somehow in the past, we weren't doing that. We weren't aware when the Bible was taken out of schools. We weren't aware when prayer was taken out. We didn't take a stand. We didn't know. But now we know. This transgender confusion has woken us all up, and now we know. And it's time for us all to speak up. And thank you for giving us the courage to be able to do that. Thank you for giving us the path. Thank you for giving us the experience. Thank you for giving us leaders like our legislators, for people like Bonnie Wallace, for parents that are becoming wise, for all of us working together to make a difference, for these college students that are getting involved. Thank you, Lord, for what company, what a privilege to be company with such people that are wanting to get involved and make a difference. And thank you so much for that. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Amen.